Okay, we're so excited for another installment of our Revolbi Parenting and Psychology Parenting series. Tonight's learning is sponsored by Anonymous for Zechus Rapua Shlema for Baruch Ben Chana Basia. So our twin girls were born right before I started graduate school for psychology. So I got to track my progress. Sometimes I would forget how long I'd been in school for, and I would look at our girls' ages and be like, that's how long I've been in school for. And sometimes I forget how old the kids are and say, well, I've been in school for this many years. And they all were parallel. And having twins in psychology grad school was always my little experiment. You know, I got to try things out on them. Electric shocks didn't work out too well for them. But, you know, always interesting to see.
Control?
Right.
Which is the control? Right. The third one.
We don't talk about that person. Yeah. Right. We'll bring them back in 20 years and then compare them and we'll see how things worked out. And it was always interesting because graduate school was a lot of work. There was a lot of class and research and field work and a lot of family things were very time-consuming, and I had to always balance it to the best of my ability. And most people were parallel with me, both in terms of my program and at the training sites I was at. It was always intriguing for them to see, wow, you have children. Like, how do you manage all this work when you have children? Like, I'm drowning here without having these children. And when I was externing or interning at LIJ Hospital, we had like a little group of trainees together who were studying DBT, dialectical behavior therapy. We had like team meetings, we would talk sometimes, and we always would check in with each other how we're doing. And at the beginning of one meeting, one young woman said, like, this past week has been so exhausting. I'm watching my neighbor's dog for the week, and I'm just so tired. I finally know what it's like for you, Melanie, because you have a cat. And I can't even begin to imagine having a cat full time and Melanie's like, you know, Yaakov has twin daughters, right? She's like, oh, I forgot about that. Oh, I was thinking about the cat, and it seemed like such a big deal. So kids and animals are not really the same in terms of raising them, amount of work. I was a little bit like, are you kidding me? Like, I'll take your dog. You could take my twins for a night, and we'll see. You know, to have very similar behaviors in terms of bathrooms and things like that. So Rav Volpe has a beautiful essay over here where he talks about a very interesting biological difference between baby animals and baby children, something that maybe we've known but never really thought about in depth before, which is going to open up the discussion about what it is that we can actually accomplish in the very, very early months of a child's life. Sometimes we don't think there's much to do when a child is that young. And for those who have children who are older, or younger, for those who have children who are older, it's never too late. We're not going to, you know, pigeonhole to this is the only time period where meaningful things can happen. There's always a lesson to take in terms of anything we can do going forward. So let's look together where he talks about the role of Ahava. We're going to talk about attachment theory and psychology, some very important stuff from Psych 101, and what Rav Volpe calls Ahava. So he writes, Nisbonin Kitsas Bedarchi Achinuch. Let's delve in to some of the ways of Chinuch. Mahein Hadrachim Hanachonos Siyesh Lalechas Behen Kasher Anu Boyim Lechaneches Iladin. What are the right ways, some of the right paths to take when we're educating our children? He quotes from a very interesting biologist, which I don't know what exactly he's quoting from, but this is fascinating. Echad ha-biologim ha-gedolim matza davar nifla. One of the biologists discovered something incredible. Hu hishva es matzavam shel balei chayim shonim b'yom ha-leida shelahem. He compared various animals on the day of their birth li-yelet b'yom ha-leida shelo, to a human being who is born. How does a human being on the day of his or her birth differ from an animal on the day of the animal's birth? Hisbarer, it turns out, shehayeled mitzad hamivne v'hatifkud shelo, child based on the child's build and function, hayatzarech od shenas ibur kidei lahagia lematzavam shel balei chayim. The animal at birth is much more ambulatory or much more mature, the brain and the body, compared to a child who needs almost another cycle of 9 months to really start becoming what the animal is almost born with. Zosomeris, this means to say, Shahirayon shel tishah chodshim, that the pregnancy of 9 months for human beings, hu bidiyuk hachatzi mimash etzarech kidei shatinok ya yitzur shalem. Pregnancy almost is only half. I don't mean to scare you. I'm not saying that there's another 9 months to go, but it's saying developmentally, when an animal is born, after whatever the animal's gestational period is, the animal is born almost ready to go. And human beings need many more months, another year, another full 9 months until they're able to start doing things on their own. And even that goes very, very slowly. Kayodua, kol bal chayim kishehu nolad. Most animals, when they're born, hu harbe yoser atzma'i me'asher tinok enoshi. They're much stronger and much more developed than human babies. Chatal Tul, a kitten. Ben Shisha Shavuot, when a kitten is 6 weeks old, Kvar Mekapetz, already jumping around. Can you imagine if human babies could jump around at 6 weeks? Hasiach Ben Hasus, the colt, the baby horse. Holech Toch Shaot. They say deer and horses are able to walk within hours of being born. Our kid, Kanahara, is 13 months, and he's not walking yet, right? That's a pretty standard middle path. But that's what happens. It takes babies a year to walk, maybe longer. Animals are very ambulatory. They're very active as soon as they're born. It takes a child a year to reach what the animal is born with. So that's the observation. That's a fact. There's no theory so far. That's just a fact. The fact is, animals are born almost ready to be, not on their own, they still nurse and they still need the support and love of their mother. But at the same time, they're already programmed, they're already able to start being on their own a little bit. Whereas human beings are very much dependent for a very long time. And this is what he quotes in The Biologist, the following theory. Toein ha-biolog, this is what the biologist suggested, sheyesh kan kavana b'yetziras ha-adam. There was almost the following intention about the creation of a human being. Shnas ha-gidul ha-rishona, the first year of life, hi ha-chelek ha-sheini shel ha-hereyon. It's like part two of the pregnancy. Maybe a little bit easier that it's out and there's no longer some of the terrible pain and discomfort. To the husbands I'm talking about. There's a second stage to the gestational period of a human being. The second part of gestation for human beings is external. In other words, if we would look at it from the following perspective, that creatures should only come out of the womb when they're ready to walk or ready to get their own food. So then for human beings, they shouldn't come out until 18 months. Shouldn't come out until a year plus. 9 months plus whatever time it takes for them to be ready, 18, 19, 20 months. If really they need 20 months from conception until they're able to actually do anything, the equivalent for a deer, why are they out of the womb for that second 9 months, that second year?
And what so this, that women want to have more babies.
That's another good suggestion, right? Otherwise, can you imagine? They're very, very terrible. That would be really awful for them. The other suggestion he makes is that there's some kind of second part of pregnancy, second part of gestational period for a human being that is a social womb, rechem sociali, kihagdarasa shel habayla, that's how the biologist termed it. Harechem hisrachev, the womb now expands. Instead of being confined to the baby's mother's body, ha'ubar nimtza kevar b'chek ha'meshbacha, now the baby sits in the lap of the entire family. Be'chelek ha'sheini shel ha'irayon, in this second stage of pregnancy, quote-unquote, hu'tzarech l'kshor yechasim im abba, im ima, im ha'achim, v'ha'achayos. The child forms meaningful relationships with more parents than just the mother in whose womb it was. With siblings. Epnei she'zohi ha'te'uda v'ha'tachlit shel ha'adam. Because human beings were designed to be social creatures. We're designed to have meaningful relationships. We're designed to grow up and form deep, romantic, intimate relationships that animals were never intended to form. Lios beso chevra, people to be part of a community, be part of a society, be part of groups. Lokamo bali chayim, hachayim liatzman. Animals, of course, animals can work together to build a dam, they can work together to find food and travel in packs. Yes, animals do things together in groups. But we don't think of animals having that same type of social function that human beings are capable of. And the great philosophers were categorizing different levels of creation. They always put mankind on their own as medaber. Because what separates human beings from other animals is the ability to socialize, ability to form meaningful dialogue and meaningful connection. And that's something that the human child needs as part of their gestational period. In theory, they should be in the womb for 18, 19, 20 months and then come out. And then they're like the animals, when they come out, they're ready to start walking and toddling around. But they need that second stage of gestation because the importance of that attachment, the importance of that relationship with their caregivers, the relationship with siblings and peers, and being able to go to mommy and me's and be able to start exploring their universe, that is so important for a human being that even though they're not ready to really walk around like the animals do at that stage, they're still born early, he's suggesting, in order to get that foundational awareness of social interaction that they need to thrive. What do you think of this idea? It's a bit of a novel approach.
I mean, you have some of those kids who don't have those social interactions. So are you saying that they lose out on?
But they still have like the mom or dad, like holding.
You're hoping that they do, but in some cases they don't.
What if caregiver means they have a wonderful babysitter who does a beautiful job taking care of them? That's different than what they can't be. People sometimes put like earphones. People put like earphones on like a baby when they're in the womb and they play music. And there's the studies for that, but you can't really. And they recognize the mother's voice, the studies show. You can't really converse with a baby, or you can't really make eye contact with a baby. These are special things that can be done during the first year of life, only out of the womb. And whether the parent is home, or parent works, or doesn't work, or the siblings are not siblings, or neighbors, or not mommy and me's, there is some more interaction and eye contact, going to the supermarket and seeing people cooing and touching, and the parent says, "Stop touching my baby, I don't know why you're doing that, so I'm asking you first." Right? So that possibility of hearing sounds and different facial expressions, babies can mimic facial expressions long before they can walk and talk. Maybe animals can do something like that too, but animals come out, they're ready to walk, and how do I eat, how do I live my life? For babies, like that, before they can walk and talk, they have to first process eye contact and learn that crying leads to being picked up and that when they're uncomfortable, they reach out. Animals do some of these things in some way, maybe for shorter term. They have snuggling and they have moments of oxytocin also, maybe. But that's really a human thing. It's really a human thing to have that bonding hormone, to have that ability to snuggle and to have skin to skin. That the hospitals are always very big on that. And the idea is that even before, and especially before, the baby is ready to go out into the world, there's this need for what we call in psychology healthy attachment, the relationship between the caregiver and the child. He writes in the next paragraph, "Hamaskana ha'ola mikach." The bottom line is, "Hishatinok tzarach lihimatze b'soch ha'arisa shel habayis." The child needs to be found in the crib of the house. Crib meaning that the house is the cradle. The cradle not just being, actually being swaddled in the crib, but the house, the social environment, is the crib, is the cradle. B'lashon acheres, to say it a little bit differently, chom, felt warmth. Pam, I'm not sure exactly what he's about to refer to, but he's referring to a different time. At a certain period in time, gidlu es yiladei hakibutzim bebatei tinokos. On certain kibbutzim, in certain communities, they would have like a central area where babies were raised. Shem tiplu behem, that they were cared for. Ha'imaus ba'o b'meshach hayom. The mothers would come, begil hatsa'ir lahanikosam. The babies are very young. Mothers would come to this, I don't call it an orphanage because the parents were alive, but there was like some central area for babies to go to, and babies slept there. And the mothers would come nurse the babies in the central place. The achar kach tiplu behem, the mothers would change them and play with them, care for them. The heim yishenu bebeis hatinokos, and the children slept there. Parents went home. Do you know what he's describing? I'm not sure exactly what he's describing. A certain kibbutzim. What? Sounds great, right? Sounds wonderful. Parents would drop off the kids there. Not daycare. I mean, infants were left there and cared for by special staff. Parents would come nurse and play and get to know their children. And then say goodbye and go home and get a good night's sleep. And go back the next day. B'meshach hazman, ha-kibbutzim shinu es hashita. Over time, these different kibbutzim stop this. They change this approach. V'chayom ha-tinokos nimtzayim etzal ha-horeim. And now it's understood, again, for better or for worse, it's understood as standard, the parent raises the child in the parent's house. Madua ba shinui. Why did this change? What happened to the old model of having babies stay in the central school for babies? Because they found out that it wasn't good for the child's development. But why? They had their mother. They had all the nutrients that come from being nursed. They had the loving care of a mother coming to visit many hours a day. The answer is, what they figured out is, yalad zakuk l'chom shel habayis. A child needs a warm home setting. With no offense to any of these orphanages or any of these institutionalized places, they don't have the warmth of a home. They might be big and they might have great resources, and they don't. But they might have all the resources in the world, but there's a certain warmth that only a home can bring. The chom perusho ahava. And what warmth means is love. And that love only can be in a home. Harbe ahava. Lots of love. Tons of love. Yela gadal davka mitov ahava. A child only can be raised and grow if they are raised with love. We actually had a mini experience like this. Our twin girls were born about 2 months early, and they were in the NICU for several weeks. Baruch Hashem, everything was fine. And for those 2 weeks, we went home. We went in the morning and spent time with them. We had some meaningful time. some skin to skin, some feeding, some changing. It's almost like practice, which no one else gets to do, which is like a weird experience, having to like practice and be like, all right, I'm done with this. We're going to go home now. And then we'll come back tomorrow. And we came back, and that was every day for 2 weeks, including one Shabbos we were there also. And it was a weird experience. It was a weird experience, like not taking your child home with you. It's like sleepaway camp, but for like infants. Just as much crying, just as much like wetting the bed. You know, it's all exactly the same as sleepaway camp, right? But so it was a very, very weird experience. And at the same time, it was something that we felt we were missing. We were missing that bringing them home. And bringing them home was a very exciting day. We had the certificate, bringing them home. There's something about the home that is very special. And maybe we naturally, as much as it sounds exciting to have nurses all the time and children sleeping out of the house, but it strikes us as odd. No, obviously the child sleeps in the home. Obviously you raise the baby in the home. So we find that odd. And at the same time, we might still be underestimating the value of the first year of life. I think a lot of people, myself included, myself first and foremost, all right, the child is 3 months old. They don't recognize anything. They don't know anything. You put them down. You do work they have to do, working from home especially. And the child will have to figure it out. Okay, so like they cry almost all the time when they're crying. I take care of them, right? You change them when they need. You feed them at the right time. Good. But like all the other time, so who cares? They're really young. When they get older, they start walking and talking. Then I'll start to interact with them. We'll smile. We'll laugh. We'll play games. But what really is being accomplished in that first year of life? All they do is cry and wake me up. And it's just a terrible annoyance. And we can't really bonding at all. However, what the studies show is that's not correct. There actually is a lot of very meaningful interaction going on, even if it's not rewarding in the same sense. But the child is developing a lot of attachment, or lack thereof, or a certain attachment style during that period of life. During that period of life, they are learning about what it means to trust someone. When I cry, does someone care? And a lot of times when we're making a psychological case conceptualization, we'll start from what was their upbringing like, not when they were 5 or 6, or 7 or 8. We're talking about as a baby. What was their temperament? Were they colicky? Were they fussy? And what kind of parenting style did they have? Was it a matter of a parent who was very busy and wasn't able to respond in the same way? When psychologists talk about parents messing up their children, and that's what we do, especially for ourselves, the most critical of ourselves, it really is because at the earliest stages, everything we do really has an impact. Everything we're doing really matters, even when the child can't talk. And that's what really Rivalbi's entire point is, that there's like the second stage of the gestation, which takes place out of the womb, for the sole purpose of the social interactions and eye contact and FaceTime that's actually spent during that period matters very much. It has a major impact. Rabbi Arlieb was told the story just recently. He mentioned that Rabbi Victor Miller, familiar with Victor Miller from Brooklyn, he has a lot of harif things that he writes about in very, very strong terms, and sometimes they're hard to digest, but there's always a point there. So someone asked Rabbi Victor Miller, he said, my baby is 6 months old, I don't know anything about chinuch, and I figure now 6 months, like before the child actually needs to be cared for, could you tell me some principles about chinuch? And Rev Miller said, your child is 6 months old, you came to ask me 6 months too late. Should have been 6 months ago to ask me. Okay, I don't think he really meant that. And not to take away from that it's too late to do anything, but chinuch doesn't start when the child is 6 or 7. We think of the age of doing mitzvahs, that's an age of chinuch for the child to start acting, coming to shul, and to daven, and to do mitzvahs, shekalulav, and put on tefillin as they get older, and that's great. But the age of chinuch doesn't just mean when the child is obligated to do mitzvahs. Chinuch means when the parents start being responsible for who the child is going to become. That doesn't just start when the child can talk, when the child can walk. It doesn't just start in the child's first year of life. Maybe it starts in the womb. Maybe it starts the second the child is born. But it's not 6 months, 8 months, 10 months in. A lot of studies have been done about attachment, have been figuring out just the tremendous effects that a child has for life based in that first year of life. In my program, one of the other firm people in my program who gave birth toward the end of the first year, and she was having a really hard time from like the administration, taking off time, taking leave. And one person who's like an attachment specialist about this area specifically, she's like, you have to take off. Like, you're never going to get this first 3 months or 6 months back. And if you could take 6 weeks or 2 months, she was so insistent of, the research shows 2 months with your baby, just holding them skin to skin or feeding them directly or being able to hold them, like you can't get that time back. Doesn't mean it's helpless or worthless afterwards, but there's something very special. Child's not saying anything, child's not giving any meaningful feedback that they're understanding, but that is shaping the child's attachment. When we use the term attachment, we're using terms that were developed in the 1950s. John Bowlby, who was a British psychologist in the 1950s, really pioneered the area of attachment. Attachment theory hypothesized that certain ways that the parent or the caregiver relates to the infant, we're talking about months old, shapes the child's trust that affects how they relate to their peers, eventually romantic and intimate relationships. It all has an effect. A lot of the work that psychodynamic or attachment therapists, of which I am not fully trained in, that's not my area of study, but a lot of those people who are dealing with depression and anxiety are working back to that stage, because it's not too late, but that's what they're reversing. It's the early, early attachment problems about trust and mistrust and low self-esteem and anxiety that come from feeling uncared for, feeling unheard, that happen in the first few months of life. That's what a certain school of therapy believes needs to be fixed in order for children to be, in order for adults, in order for people in romantic relationships to be secure, to be confident, to be able to be good partners, good employees, have good boundaries, or be able to set up defenses for themselves.
Is there anything like specifically from like a Jewish like perspective that
in the first year of life?
Yeah, like that. I don't know if there's been any research or any studies on like that aspect of attachment.
It's really interesting. There's a whole scale called attachment to God. They actually took a lot of the research about attachment and they scaled it over to attachment with God. This wouldn't apply to an infant, but just some of the theories about trust in Hashem and feeling loved by Hashem and cared for, even in moments of pain. So attachment has been broadened in that sense in a religious setting. I'm not sure if it's been... I mean, there are things we could do for young children in terms of singing songs and making them feel a certain excitement for shul and excitement for Yiddishkeit and Shabbos, but that probably doesn't start in the first year of life. I'm not sure how much of that really goes in. There's an interesting Gemara. It just reminded me of this, that in Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he praises all of his students. And about Rabbi Yoshua, his student, he says, Ashrei Yeladato. He praises Rabbi Yoshua's mother. And Rashi and others, they explain, what he was talking about is Rabbi Yoshua's mother used to, when she was pregnant, come to the Beis Medrash and like stand in the back, just so in utero he could absorb through osmosis some of the Kedusha of the Beis Medrash. And when he was born, she brought his crib to the Beis Medrash. The rabbi probably wouldn't like that very much. I'm sure it was very, very disruptive to the rabbi. But she felt there was some kind of benefit to the baby to gain through osmosis, even in the first year of life. And it's very interesting because the Gemara in Chagiga, Daf Gimel, says that Rabbi Yeshua, the same person, when he was much older, he was asking people, what are you learning? And they said, we learned the Talacha that everyone comes to Hakel. Once every 7 years, around Sukkot time, first day of Chol Moed Sukkot, everyone gathers together to hear the Torah reading. The parents and even the babies come to Hakel. And he said, why do the babies come to Hakel? He said, to give schar to those who bring them, but there's no real reason the babies are coming. Rabbi Yeshua says, that's the greatest teaching I ever heard. People wonder, why was Rabbi Yeshua so excited by that teaching? The answer is, that was him. He was that baby who came to the Beis Medrash. That was that baby. He himself attributed his success in life to be having been a baby that grew through osmosis in the Beis Medrash. So maybe he appreciated the idea of even the babies who come to Hakel. So on a metaphysical level, I don't know of any studies psychologically that have confirmed this or have shown this in a psychological perspective. I'm not sure how you would even measure that on such small babies. But from a religious perspective, there is a value to having them around, having the sounds of Torah in the home, having music of Kedusha in the car when you're traveling, even with a little baby. There is an element, I think, that the neshama does absorb the Kedusha even at a very young age.
So that's in regard to, like, Torah stuff. But in regard to, like, social, is there anything, like, I mean, we know that, like, Sarah made a party when Yitzhak was two, so obviously she was very involved in his upbringing until
right.
He was two. Same thing with Chana and like Shmuel.
Right.
So obviously the parents were very involved in the upbringing that way, to at least for the social aspect, maybe
right.
Like we're saying over here. But I'm trying to think of any other like Jewish thing of like the social aspect, not the Yiddishkeit
right.
thing.
Right. The social aspect from a Jewish perspective. I don't know. I want to think about it a little more. That's a good thing to think about from any other Jewish sources about the social component. Very interesting. So that was Bowlby's idea, this different attachment styles. And the classic study in Psych 101 that really bore this out was his colleague, Mary Ainsworth, in the 1960s. She did something that's now known as the strange experiment. It was very strange. Strange situation, they call it. What she did was she had mothers come with babies aged 12 months to 18 months. Okay, little babies, not the age of chinuch, talking about very young babies, a year old, year and a half old. And she had mothers and the baby play in this playroom with a one-way mirror. So the baby and the mother are in, they play with the toys, they get used to the environment. And a stranger comes in, and the baby is relayed to the stranger, relayed to the mother. And somehow the mother leaves the room. Mother walks out of the room and joins the experimenter on the other side of the one-way mirror. And they saw how did the child respond to the stranger once the mother left. The mom comes back, stranger leaves, mom leaves, baby's all alone, and the mom comes back. They wanted to see what do babies do when they're, I guess, no other way to put it, abandoned. They wanted to see what are babies going to do. In the 1960s, a lot of psychology experiments were like electrical shocks and things like that. There wasn't like an ethics standard board until right after this study. So they wanted to see how do babies react to being left alone, how do they react to being with a stranger, with and without the caregiver, and also very important, how do they react upon reunion with the mother who just abandoned them in the room for a few minutes. So what they found, there were three different groups of kids. And now we group attachment into four different categories, but at the time, they found three different types of kids. 70% of the kids, what they called secure attachment, most kids, secure attachment, when the mom left, and baby was all alone, baby was very upset. It was cried. Baby was bothered by being left without its caregiver. When the mom came back, the baby gave a hug and was very easily consoled. After a few seconds, it was quieted down. Mom left again, baby cried, mom came back, baby was consoled. When working with the stranger, when mom was not there, baby didn't want to play with the stranger. When mom was there, the baby ventured out a little farther. As long as mom was there also, they were able to play with the stranger. That's what they call secure attachment. Miss the parent when mom is gone, happy to see her when she comes back, interact with the stranger only when mom is there. Other 15% of kids were what they called ambivalent. These children screamed and cried intensely when the mom left the room. They avoided the stranger altogether, with or without mom. They screamed and cried when mom left the room. When mom came back, they clung to her. You can see videos online. You can type in strange situation on YouTube. You can see videos of this. And like even like hours later, leaving like the research lab, they're still like clinging to mom, like, ah! Like, don't ever take me back there ever again. And like they could not be consoled for 10, 15, 20, 30, an hour after having left the room, like being abandoned, the child is like traumatized from that. Those are the ambivalent kids. They're desperately missed when parent leaves. Even when they come back, it doesn't even help. And there were the third category, the other 15%, that were the avoidant attachment styles. They had no reaction when mom left. Mom left. They're like, sweet, more toys. Nice. Mom comes back, and they're like, you left me. I have no business for you. Goodbye. Went off into the corner, refused to make eye contact, refused to give a hug, nothing. Oh, a stranger? Nice. Play with a stranger. And they tracked these children throughout the next many years to come. And they found that these attachment styles, which were the result of the previous 12 to 18 months before the experiment, what they were like at home. How did the parents typically respond when the kid was crying? How did they respond when the kid did something wrong? Like, you know, touched something dangerous? Did they scream? Did they yell? Did they hit? Even a little kid, maybe, I don't know. And that attachment style was manifest in this child's ability or inability to separate and or reunite, to trust someone's going to come back, to be forgiving when there was a rupture in that relationship, and even to allow the person to come back or to go or to venture out and meet a stranger when we have the security of mom behind. All those things played a big role, not only as a baby, 12 to 18 months, but they tracked it, and attachment styles tended to be consistent for adults, these same adults who had been in the study decades earlier. If you look at the last sheet I gave you a printout of, in modern terms, the 1990s, they added more categories, and this is really one other way to think about it. When you're talking about attachment, and these are really, again, the results very often of the first year of life, before the child can talk or walk or do anything, a lot of these things are formed. What does the child think about him or herself? And what does the child learn to think about other people? The chart is divided where you can have four different permutations. What is the child positive or negative about their own self-image? And on the left side, you have positive or negative thoughts about their partner. So you have a secure attachment, which is the top left. A child who thinks positively about him or herself and thinks positively about other people. People can be trusted. So they have healthy boundaries because they trust themselves to say, I don't want this. This is not okay with me. I'm not comfortable with this. They have healthy boundaries in intimate relationships, healthy boundaries in professional relationships. They tend to have mutual trust and support that they're happy to give and love and help someone else because they love other people. And they also trust that they're going to get it back. They're able to resolve conflict resolution. They don't feel like if they fight for what they want, they're going to lose their sense of self or anger someone else. People who have a good sense of self and a good sense of others have secure attachment. If you look at the bottom right, the other extreme, those who have a negative sense of self and a negative sense for other people, they're what is termed as fearful, fearful attachment. Fearful attachment are people who are terrified of rejection. Other people can't be trusted. Who knows if they're ever going to come visit me? Who knows if we have a fight or if I stick up for myself, maybe they're going to never come back. They have a hard time trusting themselves, their own judgment. They have a low view of themselves. They're not capable. And if that's a terrible combination for a person who has such a terrible fear of what else is out there and very little belief in themselves, then you have these two middle categories. If you look at the top right, you have an anxious attachment style, a person who has a negative view of themselves, a person who doesn't think that they're very capable, but they do believe other people have to take care of them. They believe that this partner, that this employee, this coworker, everyone needs to help do their stuff for them. I'm not capable, I have very low self-confidence, and I'm terrified of abandonment because I need this person to live, I need this person to take care of all my needs. My entire self-worth is dependent on whether they compliment me enough, and it's never enough because I really need that. And the other permutation on the bottom left would be dismissive or avoidant, where a person has a positive view of self, but a negative and untrusting view of those around them. But they prefer to be alone. They like themselves, they're a loner, they believe that they're capable, and they don't need other people. They don't need relationships. They don't need to be with the support of others, and people can't be trusted. People always backstab me. I'm better off on my own. Think about how these personalities manifest very, very obviously in a ability to navigate work, navigate challenges, navigate relationships. A lot of the problems that we see are because people don't have a secure attachment. They either have low self-esteem or they have an untrusting, insecure, difficulty being vulnerable or trusting other people. What the attachment theory would suggest, and Revolbi is definitely saying this, is that the first year of life is really what's going to shape a lot of these things. That doesn't mean it's too late after that, but anything after that would be trying to go back and correct those exact stages. We'll get practical in just half a minute.
What did the researchers, did they connect anything? How did the 70% versus 15% versus the other 15%?
Those 70% who had a secure attachment tended to have better relationships, and people themselves rated their relationships as better, more satisfactory, they had higher paying jobs, they had more financial success. These are people who were able to fend for themselves, people who are more independent, people who are stronger.
Did they ask the parents questions about how they?
Are you saying to work backwards?
To work backwards,
good
what,
question.
What led to the 70% being one way versus the 15%? Did they ask questions that?
That's a good question. I don't remember that part of that being the study, but I believe it had to do with about responsiveness to child crying.
Got it.
In terms
that,
of,
and that would drive most time. These are just the thoughts of a partner when they're little.
I think both of them, right? A child learns both of these things from how their parent treats them. In other words, child learns about the dependability and reliability of others when they call in need, the kindness and the understanding of those around them, and they also learn about themselves. Am I bad? Am I good? Am I wanted? Am I loved? Right? That also shapes sense of self. The way the parents relate to the children both affects how the children learns to think about authority figures, intimate figures, peers, subordinates, and also how the child learns to think about themselves, about whether they're good or bad, whether they are loved, whether they are talented, whether they are trusted. Parents who always helicopters around the kid and let them go out, what does the kid learn about themselves? I can't be trusted. I can't make my own decisions. I'm not able to do these kind of things. It's amazing because Revolbi used the idea about the contrast between human babies and animal babies to say, you see, we have to be very, very loving and the whole house is a cradle and love them. Rabbi Twersky, Rabbi Dr. Abraham J. Twersky, in this book, Let Us Make Man, that I cannot recommend highly enough, which is about Jewish self-esteem. It's a phenomenal book, which I can't lend at this moment, but I'd love to lend it to you a little bit after I finish writing it up because it's a fantastic book, just finished last week. He actually also talks about the contrast between animals and humans, but the same idea. And he highlights the other side. Whereas with Volbe focused on that the need for human beings who are going to be social to have this love and this environment that animals don't need in the same way, Rabbi Dr. Twersky said, it almost can create the risk of low self-esteem. Whereas animals, they're born, they're walking, they'll get your own food. I'll help you out when you need, but go get your own food. Human beings, there's this dependency that's built in. They can't do anything themselves for a long time. And when do parents let go? When do parents stop, holding their hand when they're crossing the street? Hopefully it's not at one or two, but at some point you have to ask that question of when do you trust them? You want to hold them, you want to put them down, you want to let them cry themselves to sleep or not? It's a tough question because the child is so dependent entirely that this system, Retorsky points out, raises the risk that animals don't have, which is depressing a child's self-esteem by being too helicoptering, by being too smothering, by making the house and the environment too much of a cradle, that they can't go out of the cradle and walk around and explore and learn. Why do you let go? Even when children grow up and they can't drive themselves and they're older, very often they can't support themselves financially. So even for decades, human beings are dependent, and animals might be, after a few minutes, more independent than a human being is 20 years, 25 years after birth. It's a wild idea, but it really is this balance. Neither extreme is going to be good. Sometimes longer, right? Right? And it really is this balance, right? And really about threading this needle, which to some extent all parents mess up, and all parents mess up their children, and then all kids should be in therapy. It's my tagline for my practice. All parents mess up their kids, bring your kids to therapy. But it really is about straddling these two different values. You want to give the kid love and closeness and attention and be responsive to their cries. And at the same time, you don't want to smother them. You don't want to depress their self-esteem and become a helicopter parent, which doesn't allow them to be on their own. So let's talk practically. So what does that look like? What does it look like to actually balance these two things and have children who are both given the love and support and the secure attachment that comes from both being able to meet new people, as long as the parent is there, so they have some kind of secure network where they can venture out and meet new people and learn to do things on their own. So one thing is about the way that we, I think, have FaceTime with our families, with our children. Chatzker Rebbe commented on the Parsha. Hashem tells Moshe to come to Har Sinai. Hashem says, Alei Hahar V'Hayesham. Ascend the mountain and be there. What do you mean, and be there? Obviously, if you ascend the mountain, you'll be there. Why does God have to say, come up the mountain and be there? And the Chatzker Rebbe explained very often, we're somewhere, but we're not there. We can physically be home, but we're not home. Our mind is at work. Our mind is at what's coming up tomorrow. We're with the children and we're looking at our phones. I'm more guilty than anybody else. It's very, very hard to be there when we're there. But what does it say for a young child? Young child, I'm not talking about 6 years old. I'm talking about two, one half a year old. Apparently, the research shows the attachment is formed during the earliest months of life. So what does it say when we're there but we're not there? When we're distracted, when we're not making eye contact, when we're not present during dinner, when we're not present during playtime. When it's playtime, it's playtime. When it's work time. You're almost better off leaving the house for an extra hour or staying an extra hour. No spouse has endorsed this yet. But you're almost better off from a child attachment perspective, spending that extra hour, a half hour in your workplace, in your study or out of the house doing the work. So when you're home, you're home. There's almost something worse for the attachment and for the child's attention when the parent is home, but they're not there. It's a mila for Hashem to tell Moshe. When you're there, be there. It needs to be stated because it's not obvious that when you're there, you're there. When you come to Har Sinai, leave it all behind. And Moshe didn't eat, he didn't drink, he left it all behind with him. When he was there, he was at Har Sinai, he was on top of the mountain, he was following the rules of this location. When he was down here, he was eating. When he was up there, he wasn't eating. When he was at work, he was working. When he wasn't at work, he wasn't working. Again, I'm more guilty than anybody else with this problem. It's very, very hard. But as a goal to strive for, if we could even set aside 10 minutes where my phone is charging upstairs. Just when we're talking about little small goals. During dinner, put our phones off the table for 10 minutes, for 5 minutes. Aside from last time's topic of modeling and what a kid see and how do they use phones, putting that aside, just from an attachment perspective, of an attentive perspective, are we there when we're there? And if we could just 5 minutes more than yesterday, 5 minutes more than last week, then that's improved attachment and improved availability for our children. So that's one idea about being there, being responsive, being present when we're actually there. Number two is teaching children how to connect their feelings to what's going on. We mentioned this in a previous topic as well. The importance of having children understand what they're going through. We want to teach children the skills to be able to be on their own. This wouldn't start at the attachment age of 6 months. But when a child is very, 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 very super young, if we're responsive in a way that would be ideal, then we teach them that, okay, this is what sad looks like, this is what hungry looks like, and I'm always responsive. That isn't always possible, and sometimes based on whatever factors, child may grow up with a little bit of a difficulty processing. What they found was those who are avoidant, those who are ambivalent, it's not because the children are evil or because the children are trying to cause problems. That's how they cope with their anxiety. If I can't be secure in my anxiety, I can't be secure in my discomfort, then I'm going to avoid it altogether. Either I'm going to scream my head off until someone comes back, or I'm just going to pretend I don't feel like anything at all because that's easier. It's a defensive and survival mechanism to be able to shut off the feelings. When the child's a little bit older, and we have the opportunity to help continue the attachment, which doesn't end at 18 months or 24 months, we're hoping to continue that as the child grows up. So teach them, this is what sad looks like, and it's okay to be sad, and to verbalize. Yes, it's very upsetting when someone says something mean to you. To use that language, give them the tools, give them the language to connect their experiences so they don't become avoidant or ambivalent about those feelings. Teach them it's okay to be angry. It's not okay to hit, but it's okay to be upset when someone interferes with your goal, when someone takes away your toy, when someone stops you from doing what you want to do. I know it's upsetting. The child still screams, but at least you're acknowledging. I know you're upset. I know you're angry. I know you're sad. I know you're jealous. If you can label the emotions and connect that experience to the child, they learn to trust themselves. They learn to trust these feelings, as opposed to growing up where they're avoidant of all feelings and they have no sense of intimacy and no sense of vulnerability, because if I share how I'm feeling, I'm going to get punished for being angry or punished for being sad or yelled at for being jealous. So how can I be trusting in a relationship when I'm older, 25, 30? How can I be trusting in a relationship when I learn as a young child that I'm punished for being angry or punished for being sad? Or I don't know what this feeling is and I've learned to repress it, and then I'm in a relationship now with someone who takes this stuff seriously and I can't communicate on this language. So are we giving our children the tools to be able to process, to identify, to understand, to communicate, and to correctly pair up what they're feeling with a name? Name the feeling, understand the feeling, explain to them what it is, and give them space. Often we tell people, like, just tell me, I won't be angry. Well, except for that, like, you did that? But if we're really going to say it's okay to be angry here, it's okay to be, you know, guilty here, it's okay, then make it actually true that it's okay for the child to be vulnerable. It's okay for the child to be guilty. It's okay for the child to do something wrong, to make mistakes, to admit mistakes, and teach them, yeah, this is what guilt feels like, and this is what shame feels like, and this is what anger feels like, and this is what overwhelm feels like. And I will say two more things. Second to last thing is the importance of consistent parenting. Very often, if a child doesn't know what to expect, then the world is a scary place. Sometimes I tell my parents this, and parent screams and throws a tantrum and has a fit. Sometimes parents not paying attention. None of those are good. But at least if it's consistent, children learn that there are set consequences for certain behaviors. This is just the system of the house. So then they know this is the system of the house. But when discipline is haphazard and discipline is inconsistent, or between two parents it's inconsistent, so the child grows up with a sense of insecurity of, I don't know what people are going to say. This time I broke something and parents screamed. This time they tell me it was okay. So sometimes they fly off the handle, sometimes they don't. I'm tentative. I don't know what to expect of the world about people. Can I trust people? Are they going to suddenly snap at me and fly off the handle? Are some people going to be trusting and some people not? Or do I get the same consistent caregiving from most people in my environment? It's important of having consistent consequences for certain behaviors or certain responses to and the positive consequences. They learn that they're praised and rewarded every time they do something, that's wonderful. And last is really to find that balance of how do we encourage them to be on their own while also not letting them run wild. To let them go out there and not have to be holding their hand in the park every single second. And at the same time, not to be turning our backs on them and abandoning them. We want to have that sense that we're not suppressing their self-esteem by being helicoptering, and at the same time not being neglectful, letting them run all over the place. They have that image of a child who runs away from the parent, looks back, sees that they're there, and then keeps on going. They have that anchor. They have that secure base, that secure attachment. Then when the attachment is secure, they're free to venture out and explore new things. The attachment is too rigid, and they can't go anywhere. They're stuck. The parent doesn't let them use scissors, doesn't let them hold a knife ever. Keys, a knife is dangerous. I struggle with this. Give a kid a knife. Kid is 6 or 7, my kid's not 6 or 7, but kid's getting older, they can cut a banana with a plastic knife. So every parent, every kid is different, but just to ask the question of, the kid is still 12 and you can't use scissors, it's who knows what can happen. It's dangerous to climb up there. Okay, if we stop our kids from going on the monkey bars because it's scary, when the kid is 2 versus 18, okay, there's a little bit of a gray area between 2 and 18, but there has to be a point where we're letting them developmentally venture further and further out with that secure base to come back to. And if they fall and get hurt, then they fall and get hurt. If you run over every time they fall and get hurt and carry them back inside for a little scratch, what are they learning? What are they learning about the environment? What are they learning about their own ability to tolerate pain and problem solve? Often when a kid falls down, they first look to see if someone's watching. The parent's watching. The parent goes, are you okay? And the kid goes, eh. Or the parent goes like, no, I didn't see it. The kid gets up, dusts off, and goes back to play. It's like a broken bone. You should go over and actually help them. Don't leave them to, you know, walk off the broken bone. So obviously to an extent, but again, we're looking for that middle path over here. Are there more opportunities for us to be trusting, to let them venture out, to let them learn to trust themselves, to let them learn to problem solve themselves? If we're hovering too much, they don't learn problem solving skills. They don't learn communication skills. They don't learn boundaries. They don't learn any of these things. if we're not patient at all, if we're not present at all, then they don't have any guidance and they don't have any sense of security when they do fall. We want to be close enough to encourage them and be there when they need, but far enough so they can be on their own. Like in-laws, right? You want to be close enough to be helpful, but then not too close that it's mothering. Same thing for children. You want to be close enough to be supportive and helpful, have that attachment base, but not too close that it's mothering. You want to give them that space. Who thought? In-laws and children really work out exactly the same way. These are our takeaways for tonight. We can think about the animal kingdom and the ways in which caring for children are a little bit different. We have the challenge and the opportunity. The challenge that Rabbi Dr. Persky pointed out that we tend to smother because children are dependent on us for so long, when do we let go? And the opportunity that Rav Volpe told us about, this beautiful second stage to gestation, where we foster the child's development in an open womb, a wide womb, a house being the cradle way, we have an amazing opportunity from the earliest stages, and for those whose children are older, it doesn't end, it doesn't stop. This is what is always on the table, to develop that child's self-esteem, to develop the child's sense of confidence that they can accomplish and problem-solve and do all their own things, and to tell them, you can do this yourself, and if you need help, I'll be right over here. If we can do that, we should be zocha to have children with excellent, secure attachment all the way throughout their lives.